The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast with me, Claire Armitstead. This week, we're looking at three writers with a particularly strong sense of place. Alexandra Harris leads us out into an English graveyard to witness how weather can change the way we write about the world. Nobel Prize-winning Orhan Pamuk tells the story of Istanbul through a traditional yogurt drink. But we start with Mahesh Rao, who joined me in the studio to talk about his new book, 1.2 Billion. Although he was born in Kenya and has spent most of his adulthood in the UK, his new short story collection is set in 13 states of India. He began by reading from one of the stories, The Agony of Leaves, in which a father-in-law catches sight of his son's wife.
A few nights ago, I lay in bed listening to that dam drip. I thought a slow count during the interval between each drop would send me to sleep, but it only made me more restless. I found myself becoming anxious if the drop did not arrive on time. So I got up to go to the bathroom. In the corridor, I could see a rectangle of light coming from their room. I walked to the edge of the door. In the gap between the hinges, I saw what Vikram hides from the world. He was asleep on the bedspread, his shirt still tucked into his trousers, the sound of his snores rasping and angry. Mira was sitting up on her side, her head leaning back against the wall. There was a book open in her lap, but her eyes were closed. Her plait hung down one side, stopping at the place where the buttons on her nightie began. This was not a woman asleep. This was a woman in suspense. I have been a husband. I know that there are secrets from the world, other lives in the darkness. But Mira is an exceptional woman and does not deserve to be treated in this shabby way. Look at you, Vikram, I thought. Look at this tip-top man. A man who comes home too drunk even to talk to the woman who has spent the day sitting on the veranda, wondering what her life would have been like in a place far away from this wilderness. Mira's head did not nod or drop as I watched. That is how I know she was awake. I think she sensed my presence, and yet she did not move. She left the door ajar and the light on for me, in defiance of her husband's sour breaths. I withdrew. In the bathroom, I looked at my face, sitting solidly above my two big pyjamas. A man my age must be allowed to have a last frolic in his head. Allow me, Mira, I said to myself. Whom does it hurt? It's not as if anything will actually happen.
That is an episode from The Agony of Leaves, which is the third story of 13 in this collection, 1.2 billion. It's a father-in-law looking at his daughter, falling in love with his daughter-in-law. It's a really a tragic little chamber opera in a way.
That's right, yes.
Where is it set? I mean, one of the things you've done in this collection, and it's hinted at it in the title, 1.2 billion, is actually you're to some extent trying to sum up the whole of India. What does this say about India?
Well, this particular story is set in the Nilgiri Hills, which is a tea-growing region in the southern state of Tamil Nadu. I think this story, the setting is very key because it's set in a remote tea estate. It's about a man's isolation. It's about class in many ways. He's a man whose son is upwardly mobile, and he finds himself beached in this lonely house with his daughter-in-law and his son, and he eventually falls in love with his daughter-in-law. So the setting is key to this story, but I think the setting is key to all of them. When I started the collection, the only thing I really wanted to do was make each story very different. That was my my note to myself. But as I continued writing, I found that necessarily each story began to unfold in a different part of India. And I think that's that's a mark of the diversity that there is there, that if you're trying to reflect a multiplicity of voices and stories, you find yourself traveling in your head all over the country. And so so the first few stories, there wasn't really a plan. I just found that I was locating my stories all over the place. But then later it became a little bit more self-conscious, and then I found myself trying to focus on states where I thought there are interesting stories there. I must try and peg one of them for the collection.
You're from Mysore, which in your first novel you describe as India's second cleanest city and the home of many talented snooker players.
I think that's apparently true. After a while, you sort of forget what you've made up and what you've sort of heard. But it was India's second cleanest city when I wrote it. I'm told now it's India's first cleanest city, so the cleanest now.
So to what extent are you defined by being from Mysore?
Well, I'm from Mysore in the sense that I live there now, but I've never lived in India until about 6 years ago. So I spent most of my life in the UK, and I moved to India about 6 years ago. And I feel that I'm from there now, but I'm also an outsider. So it's an interesting perspective with which to approach your writing. You sort of feel that you are on the margins.
You grew up in England. Tell us how this came about.
I really wanted to write, and the first story that was in my head was set in India. You know, it wasn't set in Mysore particularly, but it was set in India. So I moved to India in order to write that novel, and the city which I chose, Mysore, it kind of got under my skin. You know, I initially set the novel in a fictional place. And you know, I thought it was something that had sprung from my imagination. But actually what had happened was that the city had insinuated itself into my writing. And this place that I was congratulating myself on, that I had created it, was actually just a depiction of what was around me.
So here you are writing 13 stories set in 13 different regions of India, where you have only been for 6 years. Is this not a bit presumptuous?
I don't think so. I mean, my parents are Indian. I have been going to India since I was two, probably every year. I feel that I was able to tell these stories. I mean, it'll be for others to judge whether they've been told accurately or whether they feel that there has been any level of presumption there. But I'm confident that you know, these are the stories that I've been seeing and hearing all around me, not just over the last 6 years, but you know, stories that have percolated that down through family history, through other friends, and through everything that I've read. I think everything that we read becomes a big part of our own experience, even though it's not necessarily a lived experience.
One of the themes that runs through all these stories is they all have a sort of underlying violence, whether it's a violence of sexual relationships or in particularly literal terms, bodies buried under the ground. There is a violent history on which these societies are built.
Sure. And there is a violent history, and there is a continuing aggression, I think, in the way that people have to negotiate their space. I mean, this is a crowded country. There is huge pressure on land. It's a place where law and order doesn't function in the way that you would expect it to for lots of people. There is always an aggression. I think there is a latent aggression. Power manifests itself in very violent ways in India. And I wanted to bring that to the fore in a lot of the stories, sometimes as metaphor and sometimes, as you say, literal violence.
I have made it all sound rather grim. And actually, it's very funny. And you're all constantly undercutting with comedy, as in the yoga center story in which a rich American dies, and the whole thing of people getting away with it becomes very comic.
Yeah.
How have you managed to keep your sense of humor through this grim material?
But it is funny. I mean, I think, satire is sometimes quite hard in India, because some of the things that happened are so absurd and so ridiculous, usually involving politicians or people in power who have this blustery sense of their own importance, that you can't help but laugh, you know. I think it comes also with having a little bit of an outsider's perspective, not being too caught up in the power structures or having too much invested in those power structures myself. So there are constantly very, very funny things that happen, and I think you've got to thread them into the reality of these stories, because that's what life is like there.
It comes with this book. It comes garlanded with praise from amazing citations you've got from Siddhartha Deb, Mirza Wahid, Jeet Tayil, Carmilla Shamsi. How did ordinary Indians take this book? Has it been published there?
It doesn't come out till the 25th of October.
Have you had any sort of advance?
Not yet. I mean, I am nervous about it because, you know, my novel covered only Mysore. It's a small city in the south of India. So perhaps there wouldn't be that sense of ownership or a sense of connection to that novel in the way that some people might feel to a book that has 13 stories that go across India, you know. And I think Indians, we are quite territorial as well. We want to know, what are you saying about my city or my state? But I've arrived at a position where I say we when I mean India, and I say we when I mean Britain. But in fairness, I'm equally rude about both countries. So I think that's okay.
Mahesh Rao there. And 1.2 billion is published by Daunt Books.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you've got many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
Orhan Pamuk is no stranger to telling the story of his country, Turkey, through the busy lives of his characters. His most recent novel, A Strangeness in My Mind, is a sprawling love letter to Istanbul. It has at its centre Mevlut, a street vendor who trades in boza, the emblematic Turkish drink of fermented wheat. At a Guardian Live event, Pamuk joined Mark Lawson and started by explaining how boza became a useful way in to the story he wanted to tell.
It was not the boza in my mind that I wanted to write about. I wanted to write about a street vendor so that I have an access and see the change in Istanbul, history of Istanbul, but not the big history, but daily life history of Istanbul, seen through the eyes of a low-class person who immigrated to town in 1970 when he was 12 years old. Mevlut, my character, is only 5 years younger than me, so I can identify with him. So the idea for this book was to write a sort of an epic of the city, seen through the eyes of a local lower-class person who is a street vendor, also does many other jobs, such as selling rice, cooked rice in the street, caring for tables in a restaurant, and many, many other things. He tries to make ends meet. And also, we see the change in the whole town, not the big history, capital letters, but a small, petty kitchen history, street history of this town seen through his eyes.
And the Wordsworth quote from the Prelude, "I had melancholy thoughts, a strangeness in my mind, a feeling that I was not for that hour, nor for that place." You said you were going to use this title for an earlier book. Which book?
No.
Just had it.
I'd love to write a book with a strangeness in my mind or something like in the title. Mm. Then one day I come across Wordsworth poetry. My character, Mevlut, shares with Wordsworth, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, that as he walks in the streets of Istanbul, his mind works better when he walks. Also, I share the romantic poetry's interest in imagination, in the uniqueness and definitive strength of one person's singular imagination to define that person. My character, although he is a poor street vendor, and when I hope when you're in the middle of the book, you don't look at him as a poor street vendor. You look at him as a just a human being. In fact, a constructed character. We not only see the social realities of Istanbul, we even forget about that, but we see he is following shadows and light, strange movement of the trees when there is no wind, the reflections of his ideals on the street walls, the shades, the mysterious shapes that appear when his mind is busy with other things, the packs of street dogs that has been busy at nights of Istanbul for the last 400 years. So he is, in a way, a character that a romantic poet like Wordsworth may be using. But my point is, again, to balance the social story with imagination. I tend to think that this is my most humorous novel because, in the end, I wanted this book to be funny because it's about hard realities.
You talked about it as an epic novel, and it's almost 600 pages long, which again is an older tradition. You put at the end the writing date, 2008, 2014, 6 years. So keeping the structure and composition of a book on this scale, do you have charts and family trees?
We have at the beginning of the novel a family tree. This is a long epic novel, and human imagination, as we all know, is limited. You cannot preconceive a whole 600-page novel like that. It's like thinking of a tree with all the leaves. Writing a novel is perhaps like imagining a tree. You cannot think of the whole body. You think of the trunk. You think of some of the branches. You think of some of the leaves. Then you start. An epic is very similar to a fresco. You start from a corner. You go and write for 1 year various corners. Then you continue with another. Then you change the place of the trunk. You reinvent the story. The book gets longer and longer. Your beloved ones are saying, "What are you doing there?" And you continue and try to clarify, write and clarify. Edit out and write. That's how I've been working for 40 years, by the way.
Orhan Pamuk speaking with Mark Lawson at a Guardian Live event. You can listen to the whole session or find out more about future events at www.theguardian.com/membership. But now we go outside, to St Pancras Cemetery no less, a haven of calm nestled beside the Eurostar terminal at London's St Pancras station, which has a wealth of literary connections. It is home to the Hardy Tree, a sturdy ash, around the trunk of which the novelist Thomas Hardy stacked centuries of gravestones. It's also the final resting place of the writer and campaigner Mary Wollstonecraft. Her daughter, Mary, creator of Frankenstein, is said to have come here to court her future husband, Percy Bysshe Shelley, beside her mother's grave. In the bright autumn sunshine, and at least that's what it looks like to me, and a sort of lovely cool breeze in the old St Pancras churchyard. And to me, this is a perfect autumn day, and autumn is one of my favourite seasons. Tell me how it would have been seen in the past.
Well, this is it. I wanted to know what an autumn day looks like in 1400 or 1750. And it's so difficult to find out what people thought about how autumn looks before landscape painting comes and shows us, the mellow hues of the tinted landscape. What does it look like before we're thinking of Claude and Keats? So I've been reading my way through the medieval advice books that tell you what it should be like in autumn, what you must eat in order to counter the particular autumn weathers, the little almanacs which draw pictures of different kinds of weather to expect if you hear the thunder in September. I've been thinking about that emergence of autumn poetry after Thomson's The Seasons. But that's in the 18th century. century. You know, it's actually a very recent phenomenon that we should be so fascinated by dead leaves.
If we go right back to, say, Roman Britain, they didn't really see four seasons at all.
The classical world does. So the classical world has four seasons. But then it seems that the Anglo-Saxons were thinking very much in terms of a binary year with light and dark, summer and winter. And that's the kind of northern model that comes to us from the Germanic countries. But as that melds together with Latinate influence, you start to get people thinking about a more sort of gradual, progressive way through the year.
Your subtitle is Writers and Artists Under English Skies, so it's very much a writerly impression. You're arguing that actually they are creating the way we see. There is no such thing as an objective autumn day.
That's it. Looking around now, my mind is full of the words of Shelley and Keats, and everybody has their reservoir of things that they've looked at and seen. It doesn't have to be even, you know, particularly sort of poetic. Films, they provide our imagery, I think, for everything we see around us. And so we are partly creating the world around us. And though the thermometer reads the same to everyone who looks at it, actually the temperature will feel slightly different. The rain will be experienced as a drizzle by one person, as a great Victorian downpour by another. And I just think those shifts are so creative in us.
Since we're sitting in the old St Pancras churchyard, which does have connections with Shelley, because Mary Wollstonecraft is buried here, not least, there's a fascinating thing that a story you tell about that summer when Mary Shelley created Frankenstein, and the weather and how different people saw the weather. That particular summer, Wordsworth saw it as incredibly dull and dank and dispiriting, but she saw something very different.
This is 1816. There'd been the enormous eruption of Tambora volcano the year before, and the atmosphere was laden with volcanic particles that were blocking out the sunlight. This was the year without a summer, and yes, people experienced it differently. So the Shelleys and Byron are together on Lake Geneva, and they're looking out at these sublime thunderstorms. Mary Shelley is enraptured by this, terrified, but also sees this fearsome energy in it. But back in England, and there's Jane Austen, say, who's looking out at drowned fields thinking, you know, this is people's livelihoods gone, and this is dreary and depressing, and some people may think this is sublime, but I think this is disastrous. So I think people's sensibilities are so easily readable in these moments of weather crisis.
Moving into the 20th century, one of your areas of expertise is Virginia Woolf. And you talk very interestingly about how attuned she was to how people wrote about the weather, and particularly with reference to Orlando.
Yes, I can't help myself writing about Woolf because I think she's such an extraordinary reader of our weathers. In Orlando, she takes her heroine hero through 350 years by changing the weather of each century. And it seems to her that the Enlightenment does actually look clear and bright because of the kinds of culture that are coming out of it, the kind of artistic ideals. You know, people are wearing brocade floral dresses. That's the ideal fashion. And it projects a certain idea of the weather, and she thinks that the Victorian world looks to her dark and damp and dreary, and ivy is growing in profusion and the vegetables are all coming up. There's a sense that because the Victorians are very interested in forms of melancholy and mourning, because their homes are darkly panelled, they value privacy and enclosed indoor spaces, all of that has an effect on the way we think their weather was. And so I've been trying to determine what the actual meteorological record was for the 19th century and compare it and say how far is what's happening out of the window actually reported in the kinds of literature and art that come out of that moment. And the two are just constantly playing off each other in a way so complex I think we haven't quite got to before.
This is a sort of huge book, thick, heavy book, and it represents years of scholarship. It's a curious book to write at this time because it's very, very invested in literature. Your touchstones aren't sort of the things that are happening to the weather now. They're very much about the things that the writerly imagination has communicated in ages past.
Partly I wanted to work out a sort of shape for a history of literature, as I've been reading it, and I thought that one of the best ways to do that is to lie down on the grass with one writer after the next and watch the sky and see it changing. So that was, to me, a sort of personal obsession. But there's also an element here of my trying to work out what I think about climate change. There's a way in which I think the statistics, the cause to action, can be a little bit alienating. I can't always feel the urgency of it in my day-to-day life, but when I read, for example, the diaries of Ralph Joslin writing in 1647 about a glimmer of sunlight, there's something very real and immediate about that. It brings home to me what has changed across time, our position now. That kind of long view, for me, gives such weight to our current preoccupations. And so it's helped me, certainly, to really think about where we're going now. On the last night of the 18th century, the heroine of Virginia Woolf's Orlando leans out from her London window. In the cool, clear air, she surveys the smooth domes and magnificent vistas of the city. All is light, order, and serenity. But then, as she watches, a rapid gloom starts to close in. Within moments, there comes a dramatic meteorological alteration. A turbulent welter of cloud covered the city. All was darkness, all was doubt, all was confusion. The 18th century was over, the 19th century had begun. This is how time passes in Woolf's historical pageant. The atmosphere of English life in different eras is established through these changes in the air. Life changes in accordance with the newly Victorian weather, so skirts are worn to the ground and tablecloths follow suit. Ivy grows in profusion. In the muffled gloom, evasions and concealments are bred almost as quickly as children. Immediately, we start thinking of wood-panelled rooms, yards of black taffeta. Why does the 19th century, seen through the telescope of time, look so very damp? Well, parts of it were verifiably wet. Springs and autumns in the 1830s and 40s were characterised by high rainfall, as were the summers of the 1870s when crops rotted in the fields. There was also the man-made atmosphere to contend with. Industrial smoke generated its own pervasive black clouds. But Victorian England also saw plenty of fine weather and periods of drought. Measurable quantities of rainfall and cloud cover were not really, I think, Woolf's point. Her method in Orlando has much more to do with a sense that as cultural preoccupations change, we find affinities with different conditions. Weathers gather associations, and in a constant exchange of subject and object, these associations shape our experience of weather. 5 years ago, I spent a summer reading Anglo-Saxon poetry and chronicles. The fascination with frost seemed to run so deep that even the language was frozen into its forms. Winter Kiareg, winter bitter, winter Yawortha. Where was the sun? I kept reading, waiting for the spring. It came in the lyric poems of the 13th century. Lenten is come with love to town, they sing. The long hold of ice is over. April is where the medieval stories begin. I knew then that I was going to have to read on through the 15th century and the 18th century, watching to see whether the air was so very clear, and on through the gathering clouds towards Wyndham Lewis's 1914 proposal of a new climate for modern life. The thermometer may be the same whoever reads it, but our experience of weather is more than statistical. It's made up of personal moods and memories. An evening sky is full of other evenings. A mist may be given its identity by a line from a song or a half-remembered film. The weather is made for us, partly by writers and artists who have set down permanently their response to some fleeting effect. The subject I was chasing through libraries and over windy hills was not the weather itself, I realised, but the weather as it is daily recreated in the human imagination.
That was Alexandra Harris reading from her book, Weatherland, Writers and Artists Under English Skies. It's published by Thames and Hudson. And I'm afraid that's all we have time for today. Thanks to Mahesh Rao, Orhan Pamuk and Alexandra Harris. As ever, we'd love to hear from you. You can leave comments on the podcast page. Just search for Guardian Books Podcast. Or you can email me direct at claire.armitstead@theguardian.com. Next week, we're taking a turn on the spooky side with Audrey Niffenegger for Halloween. Until then, from me, Claire Armitstead, and my producer, Susanna Trezillian, goodbye.